caller, check the folder.
Here we go, check it out, right.
Now you got the scoop, check the guest troop well. On the chest, niggas still use the word fresh blessed. You see the structure, build the constructor.
Greetings, this is Mikey J.
Now this one is dedicated to
CKUT 90.3 FM right here in Montreal. Playing the hits, playing your favorites.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to a new year with CKUT 90.3 FM's News Collective. It's the first show of 2025, and it's safe to say a lot has happened since we've been on break of really, really great geopolitical importance. But first, let me be the first to welcome you to Off the Hour every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern. So to give a brief overview of the contents of this week's show, we're going to be looking at some timelines of the latest events happening at the federal level of Canadian politics, as well as looking at past and future dynamics of our relationship with the United States government. And this evening, we'll have the pleasure of hearing from members of the CKUT News Collective, so namely Joel, Kai, Kayla, Laurence, Nelson. Leading today's discussion, my name is Kaya. I will be less of your host and more of the mediator of today's conversation. So as an international student here in Montreal, I'm neither Canadian nor American, and my job here today is to stand in for you, the listener, and cut in for clarifications when I need them. So I'm here to lay bare my woeful ignorance, if you will, so that we have the opportunity to learn together. So we'll be getting right into it with a timeline of Trudeau's recent resignation with Laurence and Kai leading this section. So go ahead, guys.
All right, yeah, thank you very much. So basically, this all kind of started in the summer of 2023, thereabout, with the Liberals steadily losing popularity across the board in federal polling. And then in June 2024 and September 2024, Liberals suffered defeats in by-elections in Toronto and Montreal. So these were historically safe Liberal districts, as a review. So Toronto's St. Paul's district went to the Conservatives, and the LaSalle and Mont-Verdun district here in Montreal went to the Bloc Québécois. So after these defeats, there was a letter from 24 Liberal MPs demanding that Justin Trudeau resign, saying that he was no longer capable of leading the Liberal Party.
And how important is it that it's 24? Like, is that a lot of MPs? Is that little? I know that there's 300 about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty substantial number. I mean, yeah. it shows a lack, it chiefly shows a lack of cohesion within the party.
Right.
Right. So if you have a set of like two dozen Liberal MPs putting their name onto a letter calling for the Prime Minister to resign, it's rather embarrassing for him, and it just shows kind of ruptures within the Liberal Party.
Yeah, and it's his own party, right? So Trudeau is the leader of the Liberals?
Yes.
So then that's sort of the declining popularity of the Liberals sort of made a rift in the ruling Liberal NDP coalition, which caused NDP leader Jagmeet Singh to tear up the confidence and supply agreement that the NDP had with the Liberals on September 4th, 2024. And so this created the possibility of an early election. Jagmeet Singh very publicly accused Trudeau of having caved to corporate greed, and he positioned himself as the only one who could stand up to Poilievre and his cuts. So he came out with sort of a lot of fiery criticism of the Liberals, but in the next few months, his actions wouldn't really back that up.
Right. So moving into November, as we all know, Trump won the 2024 elections in the U.S., and he very swiftly threatened 25% tariffs on Canada, as well as China and Mexico. So according to his post on Truth Social, November 25th, the tariffs would be in place until, quote, drugs, in particular fentanyl, and all illegal aliens stop this invasion of our country, a direct quote. So obviously 25% tariffs on Canada would be ruinous. We'll discuss that a little bit later. But moving on into December.
So then, this is skipping over a few things. There were a few no confidence motions as well brought by the Conservatives as sort of an attempt to force an election. Eventually, one of those was actually supported by the Bloc as well. But the NDP continued to vote in favor of the government. And obviously, if a no-confidence motion passes, then that means that there's going to be an election. So there wasn't an election in the end before the holidays. And then on December 16th, 2024, Chrystia Freeland, who was the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, resigned after Trudeau told her he was going to replace her as finance minister and give her another position in a cabinet shuffle. And in her resignation letter, Freeland criticized the irresponsibility of Trudeau's political gimmicks, saying they needed to keep their fiscal powder dry, so to speak, in the face of Trump's tariffs, which was a reference to the GST holiday, which Trudeau had given Canadians over the holidays. Which many saw as a last-ditch attempt to increase support for the Liberals.
Could you clarify what a GST holiday is?
Basically, it's a holiday on sales tax, so okay. Canadians wouldn't be paying sales tax for, I think it's like 2 months or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it was for food, like gifts as well. There were like toys. Yeah. There was a list of exemptions.
Something that happens often in Canada?
I've never heard of that happening before.
No, I don't believe it's very. Okay. It's certainly not common. It's not very precedented.
Okay.
So by December 20th, 2024, the NDP announced plans for a no-confidence motion, which was pretty much the nail in the coffin, right, for Trudeau's hold on the minority government.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that came right after Parliament stopped being in session.
Right.
So basically they had the opportunity to bring down the government, and the Conservatives called their bluff once or twice during the fall, and they didn't. And there's different theories as to why that was, right? The Conservatives say it's because of Jagmeet Singh's pension, that basically his pension kicks in February, so he wants to to, I don't know, wait until he gets his pension, basically, which I don't know how many other people really agree with that. Another more charitable analysis would just be that the NDP are also in a very bad political position. So an election right now would not be in their favor, and they're trying to sort of delay until they can be less associated with Trudeau and the Liberal government. But yeah, that sort of raises the question of who's going to be...
Well, yeah, I mean, so in January 6th, 2025, Trudeau announced his intent to resign as prime minister and the leader of the Liberal Party by March 24th. So he basically asked the governor general to prorogue parliament until March 24th, ostensibly to allow for a cooling down of political rhetoric. I don't know if anybody wants to, you know, dig into that a little bit. The move was widely seen as self-serving. It was done in order to give the Liberals time to choose a new leader, because there's... we'll talk about that in a little bit. Basically, prorogation of parliament means that there can be no new confidence votes until March 24th. So it prevents an election from being called until that time. So in terms of who's running for the new Liberal leader,
exactly. This is people in the docket. This is sort of giving the Liberals time to choose a new leader. And the Liberal Party usually reserves 3 months for a leadership race. So this gives them just under 3 months for a leadership race. And this is not a very coveted position right now, because the Liberals are really staring down the barrel of complete destruction in the election that's to come. But on the upside, you know, whoever becomes Liberal leader will at least get to be prime minister for a time, who knows for how long. But it seems like a good number of people sort of scared off by this. So major cabinet ministers like François-Philippe Champagne and Mélanie Joly have announced that they're not running. So right now, the race seems to be between Mark Carney and Chrystia Freeland, two people. Now, neither have officially announced that they're running, but they're both basically tacitly admitted that they are running. And we saw Mark Carney actually appear on The Daily Show on Monday, and we can play a short clip of that. And here he basically all but admits that he's running.
When I say run, I mean not for office. I mean f-ing run. Yeah. The other way. That it's so hard. It's when the headwinds are like that, it's really difficult for a candidate to come in who is saddled with the policies that are on.
But let's say.
Oh, boy.
Let's say just throwing out a
look
wild
at you trying to preserve the relationship
a wild hypothetical. Let's say. The candidate wasn't part of the government. Let's say the candidate did have a lot of economic experience. Let's say the candidate did deal with crises. Let's say the candidate had a plan to deal with the challenges in the here and now.
Sneaky, you're running as an outsider.
I am an outsider.
Wow, that's all. So you're going to be coming in there.
So you see Carney positioning himself as an outsider, and we can see how this plays for him, you know? On the one hand, it definitely is an advantage to not have been actively a member of Trudeau's cabinet like Freeland was, you know, at Trudeau's side for 9 years
in a row. I mean, like, I think Poilievre, I don't have a direct quote from this, but Poilievre was criticizing Freeland and everybody else who was considering running for the leader of the Liberal Party, calling them basically the same thing as Trudeau. So I think her close association with Trudeau would be probably the most... detrimental to her campaign.
Exactly.
But he's an outsider, right?
So in a sense he is, but then also his position as part of the sort of global financial elite could also play against him. So those are sort of two characters right now. Might be our next prime minister, Carney or Freeland. But I mean, let's be real. None of these people are going to be prime minister for very long. And the person who is expected to be, you know, if the winds don't change, the next prime minister of Canada is Pierre Poilievre. So... think we're going to get into that.
Right, so we're going to have a quick little ad break, and after we're going to discuss who exactly could be the next Prime Minister of Canada. So we are going to be discussing who exactly is Pierre Poilievre. We'll be right back.
An Inuit community food center in Iqaluit, Nunavut has found a way to increase access to traditionally harvested food, and it wants to share what it's learned with your community through a free digital resource. Traditionally harvested, or country food, includes caribou, Arctic char, and seal, Access to these foods has become more difficult due to colonization. But Kyuktuvuk Community Food Center is working with local hunters to change that. They now offer a regular supply of country food on a sliding cost scale. If you want to learn more, reach out to info@kyuktuvuk.ca. That's info@kyuktuvuk.ca.
Welcome back. So we're going to be here with Kayla and Nelson, who are going to be discussing and introducing us to who could potentially be the next Prime Minister of Canada after the sort of breakdown of what we've been in for so long. So you guys can go ahead.
Yeah, so who is Pierre Poilievre? He was born in Calgary to a teen mother and actually raised by his adoptive parents. And he always had a strong interest in politics from a very young age. He was involved in conservative politics through canvassing for the local conservatives and working with the Canadian Alliance. He was also one of the youngest elected conservatives in 2004. He was 25. He has a sharp tongue and an abrasive attitude towards the left that's garnered him a deluge of support from young conservatives who are disillusioned with high food prices, high gas prices, and high housing prices.
So, yeah, and he's kind of positioned himself as this kind of like energetic but also polite figure for conservatives. And I'm just going to play a quick soundbite from an interview that he did with Jordan Peterson, who is this strange dude who's written, I guess, sort of self-help books. He was a psychology professor at U of T until recently, and now he's kind of on the conservative grift. But I'm just going to play this quick bit where he was kind of positioning himself against Trudeau and kind of, I guess, kind of contrasting himself with Trudeau. It'll kind of give us an idea of where he's looking to take things if he is to become PM, most likely to become PM.
By far, we had a population growth of 1.2 million in 2020.
Inspired in large part over the 9 to 10 year period that Trudeau has been governing. And so when you are trying to put your finger on what went so wrong, so calamitously wrong, what do you think the major contributors were? I mean, there's a lot of hydras whose heads we're encountering at the moment, and I imagine it's relatively difficult to trace a causal pathway, but what did we do wrong as a country?
Well, I mean, what I'm about to say is not a shock to anyone. We have a prime minister who is dedicated to an extremely radical ideology. It is just a rehashed socialism that has been discredited again and again and again throughout the ages. And his basically authoritarian socialism has guided him throughout his entire prime ministership. He believes in a state that controls every aspect of your life, your money, your speech, your thought. He controls the economic, all of the industries of the country. Every time that has been tried, it is a complete disaster. So there's no mystery involved. It is the same old disastrous outcome that results from the same old disastrous policies.
Right, that have demonstrated themselves.
So, yeah, you can kind of hear a bit of his love for buzzwords, loving calling Trudeau a socialist and all of these sort of things. He's really kind of in bed with the online right in a lot of ways. But I think it's important for us to realize that he is kind of dangerous for labor, and I'm going to kind of transition into that. He's been wanting to implement right-to-work laws here in Canada. So back in 2012, he launched a campaign to bring those to Canada, which, for those of you who don't know what those are, it's basically laws that stop employers from creating a closed shop, which means like requiring union membership to be employed at a company. So he was wanting to bring those in. Also, he's kind of tried to court the right by attending, or the alt-right rather, by attending right-wing encampments and protests, like the recent anti-carbon tax demonstration on the border between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And also, Alex Jones is a big fan of Polyevre.
That's a great sign.
but yeah, and you know, it's very easy for Polyevre, if he wanted to kind of distance himself from someone like Jones, but he really hasn't taken the plunge into doing that. But yeah.
And my question is, like, how much of a new player in the field is Polyevre? Like, is he someone that's had sort of a steady rise, or is he really just, like, emerging, like, bam, I'm the new, like, stand-in leader?
I mean, I would say that he has, I mean, he's been around since 2004, but, you know, it's been sort of a meteoric rise as of late,
mm-hmm.
I would
say. So he's been lurking, kind of lurking. Yeah.
And so I think now he's really kind of risen to this sort of new face of a conservative party that isn't so brash as, say, Trump, but is still kind of using the similar rhetoric, similar buzzwords to kind of create some sort of, you know, reaction out of people, like we heard in the interview with Peterson, just like very willing to throw around words that really, and baseless accusations about who people are. But I think what's interesting about him is, you know, maybe how the world is viewing him. I recently read this Vox article that was published earlier this year, I think it was back in April, calling him the polite Trump. And I think that's something that, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about Trump later, but he's very much riding this wave of Trump conservatism, but kind of doing it in his own way. And I think it kind of minimizes how dangerous he could possibly be for things like labor, for the climate, for a lot of these sort of things. But yeah, and you know, even if he does seem polite, he's really also, like, you know, riding a wave of the anti-immigrant sentiment that Trudeau was kind of starting up earlier this year with caps on immigration, you know, changing, you know, all of that sort of stuff, and using similar rhetoric there. So although he may be polite, I think he's also, you know, he's doing a lot of the same things, but in a different package. Yeah. But,
well, my question about, you mentioned like Trudeau kind of bringing up anti-immigration sentiments, like as someone who is an internet, like I'm here on a study permit, I am an international resident here in Canada. From what outsiders hear about Canada is that, like, you know, they have a population crisis, they need people, they need workers, they need, like, skilled laborer, in heavy air quotes, you guys can't see that, but skilled labor. Like, is that not true?
I don't think that's true.
Why? Can you elaborate?
Our population has grown at a higher rate than, like, any other OECD country over the past 3 years. We've had, like, a huge explosion in people, especially in temporary residence, and a lot of that is due to the Liberals mismanaging our immigration system. And I think it's really important to be able to address the issue without demonizing immigrants themselves, because obviously anyone who's coming here is just coming here for opportunities and for a better life, and we should respect that. And so I think, but at the same time, I think that they're very credible people outside of just Poilievre who have said that the immigration, particular temporary immigration, was sort of out of control.
Yeah, and I think it is important to point out that, you know, there is room in this debate about immigration to talk about mismanagement, but I think what's happening is a scapegoating of the people who are already here, who came here, who are documented, and even those who are undocumented, because there's recent measures that are leaving people without status here in Canada. And so, you know, in regards to a lot of these different issues, I mean, the immigrants can be used as scapegoats. I mean, we talked about this last year a lot with what's happening here in Quebec specifically, but what's also happening on the national stage, since immigrants can't vote. You know, for instance, we're about to have an election. They're not going to be voting in this. And so, or I shouldn't say immigrants can't vote, but those who are just permanent residents or temporary workers, So what that means is, you know, they can kind of just say a lot of things like blaming the housing crisis on immigrants and, you know, using a lot of these, basically thrusting it on people who are not part of the electorate so that they can more easily, like, alleviate those concerns for their party and for themselves. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. And that's something that I fear. That's something that Trudeau definitely played a part in. But I think the same can be said for, you know, I'm afraid that Poiliev will kind of increase that rhetoric and inflame it in a lot of ways. But yeah.
Right. So next we're going to be looking at the future of Canadian relationships, sort of with the coming Trump administration. Obviously, that's going to mark a moment of shifting. And right after a brief ad break.
Government for personal reasons.
Do you know that community radio stations in Canada broadcast in more than 65 different languages? This is where stories come alive and where we come together. But as big international media dominates the spotlight, local news and local voices struggle to be heard. Our government must help these local stations continue to do what they do best, serve the unique needs of our communities. We're asking you to go support the Community Radio Initiative at mycri.ca. Stand with us for community radio future.
Okay, well, there's something that I guess I've been thinking about a lot in terms of like dynamics of Canadian and American government systems is that, like, I understand that the Canadian system is based on like parliamentary history of, you know, English colonization, but that's like, is there something particular about the parliamentary versus presidential structure between America and Canada that like subconsciously shapes how Americans and Canadians view their government and view the power systems? Like, is there something there that differentiates them?
Well, okay, I'm coming at this from like an American perspective. I was raised in the U.S. I'm familiar with U.S. politics more so than Canadian politics. But I feel like maybe you can jump in on this, Kai.
Yeah.
But there is, I feel like U.S. politics is dominated by like the presidential races,
right.
And at least in the minds of Americans, that's really the one race that matters, and it's very centered on like the person running. So politics becomes like very focused on like the personalities of the people who are running for president rather than like parties. Where I feel like Canadian parliamentary politics, the party kind of has more of a hold on like the individual prime ministers or the party leaders. So the party has more of a cohesive. I don't know if it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. U.S. politics is very bombastic. It's very personal. Often the rhetoric gets, especially now in our very polarized times, the rhetoric can get like very personal and very nasty. But Canadian politics I see as being slightly more focused on institutions rather than individual personalities. So that might be changing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of things at play there because individuals do have a lot of power. For example, you know, the leader of the Liberal Party. I mean, arguably the Prime Minister actually has more power than the President in certain ways because the leader of a party can sort of whip, that's the actual term, they whip their MPs into doing what they want, into voting for bills that they want to get done. And if you have a majority government and you're the Prime Minister, you basically dictate everything. You know, you tell your MPs what to do. So anyways, in terms of hierarchy, it's probably even more hierarchical because in the U.S. often you have a situation where you have, you know, a president of one party, then Congress or Senate of another party, and then there sort of have to be more compromises there. But I mean, I wouldn't want to focus too much on comparing with the American system, I guess. I think in terms of, I mean, there's so much to talk about here, but we want to talk about the Trump administration.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and
there
the
were
tariffs,
some very
so.
There's some very direct yeah, questions about that. You know, Trump tariffs and Canadian sovereignty here. So particularly, I mean, we want to talk about the tariffs, and we also want to talk about Trump's comments about Canada being the 51st state. So to give you a rough recap of what's been going on, in case listeners haven't been paying attention. You know, maybe it's best to not pay so much attention to the news. Yeah. It's kind of a circus. But so in late November, Trudeau, along with Finance Minister Dominic Leblanc, went to Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida to discuss Trump's tariff threats. As we said previously, the tariff threats were 25%. That's what Trump has threatened on Canada as well as Mexico and China. So it was in this meeting that, as Fox News reports, Trump joked about Canada becoming the 51st state if it couldn't handle the economic repercussions of a 25% tariff. So most of the subsequent talk of Canada being the 51st state has come out through memes posted to Donald Trump's Truth Social page. So, like, a picture of the U.S. and Canada overlaid with the American flag, things like that. These also come along with calls to acquire Greenland and the Panama Canal, which we won't be focusing on in this segment, but which could be a segment for a future show. So at first, Canadian politicians dismissed these comments as jokes intended to primarily humiliate Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who at the time had not yet announced that he would be stepping down. But Trump kept repeating the idea over and over and over. Just over a week ago, he escalated these comments during a press conference at Mar-a-Lago. I don't know if you want to play
that.
Yeah,
we got a clip there, let's listen to it.
Assumption that you're serious about making Canada the 51st state of the United States. The leader of the Conservative Party in Canada said, under no circumstances, will right. ever be the 51st
then he
state.
Maybe he won't win, but maybe he will. I don't care.
You had suggested
that listen, I don't care what he says.
But Sir Rofes, you're considering military force to acquire Panama and Greenland. Are you also considering military force to annex and acquire Canada?
No. Economic force. Because Canada and the United States, that would really be something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line, and you take a look at what that looks like, and it would also be much better for national security. Don't forget, we basically protect Canada. But here's the problem with Canada. So many friends up there. I love the Canadian people. They're great. But we're spending hundreds of billions a year to protect it. We're spending hundreds of billions a year to take care of Canada. We lose in trade deficits. We're losing mass. We don't need their cars. You know, they make 20% of our cars. We don't need that. I'd rather make them in Detroit.
So there's so much. There's so much funny stuff to go off of there. I mean, it's funny and it's not funny, right? But I mean, okay. One obviously ironic thing is him calling the border between Canada and the United States an artificially drawn line when he's the, you know, safe, strong borders guy. And now borders are just lines, right?
Right. I mean, I don't think he'd call the border to Mexico an artificially drawn line, but yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it's concerning that the rhetoric that he's using, like the artificially drawn line comment, I think is pretty, you know, it's concerning in, with the perspective of Canada's territorial sovereignty. So he said he's not considering military force for Canada, which fantastic. No, he's not going to invade Canada, but economic force, which I suppose would be in the form of tariffs and the like, is still on the table. So this puts Canadian politicians in a rather difficult situation, as we've seen. So they want to respond to Trump's threats, obviously, but they're also kind of desperately hoping that he won't impose these tariffs. And there have been differing responses based on, you know, provincial allegiance and things like that. So we'll get into that. But what do we make of these threats? So how seriously do we take them? Because I think the overwhelming response to Trump's threats at first was that it was just a joke. You know, Trump loves to bluster. He says things that are off the cuff. But as he's been repeating these comments, a lot of Canadian politicians are saying, wait, no, we should take it maybe not totally literally. I don't think Trump is likely to acquire Canada. You know, it's not even in the realm of possibility. But taking the threat seriously as a marker of intent.
Yeah, and like even though like I understand like it is very his like sort of like dramatic demeanor when he's like saying these things, like it's natural to push it aside as, oh, it's a joke, he's being dramatic, like it's hyperbolic. But what isn't a joke, you know, is the reality of the U.S. like the reality of trade being involved in a sort of like neocolonialism and the U.S. as like an imperial power. Like they do acquire foreign land, like state of Hawaii, for example. Like that's not a joke. So
yeah, I mean, like the U.S. has a history of being right. an expansionist imperial power. I mean, just the idea that it would be requiring even, you know, Greenland and the Panama Canal in in a global order, like post, you know, the founding of the UN and post NATO, it seems kind of, I mean, it seems completely ridiculous. Like, it seems absurd. But I do think that the Trump tariff threats are very real. The economic pressure that he's going to apply to Canada is very real. And premiers have had differing responses to that. I don't know if you wanted to jump
in.
Sure.
I mean, okay, there's so much to talk about here. You know, Trump, he might not be the most knowledgeable guy. Might not be, you know, a great businessman. For example, he thinks that the trade deficit that the U.S. has with Canada, where we export more to them than they import from us, and then we import, he thinks that's basically us ripping them off. He's saying, oh, Canada's ripping us off $200 billion because they export more to us. That's not how that works. You know, just the U.S. has a trade deficit with most of the countries it trades with. The U.S. is a net importer of things because the U.S. is a very rich country. And a lot of what we export to the U.S. is raw materials, particularly crude oil, lumber, stuff like that, which we could be refining in Canada, and instead we're sending over to the United States. So in many ways, what he's saying is ridiculous and completely illiterate business-wise. But Trump is very good at one thing, and that's media. He has a very good media instinct, and I don't know, he's good at getting into fights with people. And I think that's really what he's doing here. He can smell weakness, and he can smell the weakness of the Canadian political landscape right now. I'm not going to, you know, blame it on Trudeau individually, but definitely the Canadian political landscape is very precarious right now. You know, we're facing an election. We don't know when it's going to be. The government's very unpopular. And then the idea that the conservatives are, you know, somehow going to come in and fix this or something like that is not, I mean, one thing we heard in the clip was the very beginning, where the reporter was telling him the conservative leader is saying, oh, you know, we're never going to be the 51st state. And he was like, ah, whatever, who cares what he thinks? He doesn't care what Poiliev thinks at all. It's not important to him.
Right. I mean, like, and there have been, like, differing responses to threats of tariffs. I mean, the Alberta Premier, Danielle Smith, said in a meeting actually today that she would oppose an export ban on Alberta oil as a retaliatory measure to the proposed tariffs. Quebec was also ruling out using its power exports to the U.S., mainly electricity in their case, as a retaliatory weapon. In contrast, the Ontario Premier Doug Ford said he would be in favor of withholding energy exports to the U.S. In Ontario's case, a lot of U.S. states rely on Canadian electricity, Ontario electricity, particularly in the northeast regions. So there's already, I mean, like the response from the Canadian government has been pretty split.
Yeah, it shows division. It shows a lack of central leadership. And in all this chaos, basically, our saving grace, our knight in shining armor is none other than Douglas Ford, who basically has become Canada's representative on the world stage because Trudeau's out of commission. So he's been appearing on American TV all over, you know, CNN, Fox News, even in the UK, he was on the BBC. And so we can play a little clip of him on Jesse Waters Primetime, which is a popular Fox News show, just for a little bit.
Guy. Yeah, what's your problem with the United States absorbing Canada?
Well, first of all, Jesse, you know, I love the U.S. I love Americans, and I get it. You know, President-elect Trump is a real estate tycoon. He's made billions, but that property's not for sale, as simple as that. But I have a better idea, Jesse. Why don't we create Fortress AmCan and make sure it's the richest, wealthiest, most prosperous jurisdiction in the two countries anywhere in the world? We have the critical minerals. We have the energy. We have the electricity that America needs. And there's only one place I'd want to sell it to, and that's the U.S.
Well, you could sell it to us, or we could all own it together. And that's a choice we can all make together. You say this isn't for sale, but everything has a price. The million-dollar man says that. Can you think of this more as a merger instead of an acquisition? Don't think about being taken over. Think about this as a coming together.
Yeah, we can come together.
What do you think of that?
I mean, This is a pretty unenviable position. Obviously, I mean, I don't really take seriously what Jesse Waters says. Although apparently, I mean, Trump is appointing a lot of Fox News alumni to his cabinet, so maybe I should.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's what do I want to say here? I think the immediate threats to the Canadian government and the Canadian people are these tariff threats. I don't think that, like, you know, Canada being acquired by the U.S. is a possibility in, like, at least...
Well, I think what's funny about that clip is Jesse Waters' sort of playful... To him, he is treating it like a joke, you know?
Right.
Oh, you know, why can't we just have a nice, not a hostile takeover, but a nice little merger? It's going to be fun, you know?
But it's not a joke if he's talking about it on national television.
It's joking, but it's also extremely disrespectful to any Canadian who is proud to be Canadian, proud of our national sovereignty.
It's like a passive-aggressive high school bully who's, like, you know, kind of joking and kind of isn't, but it's kind of at your expense.
And it's way worse with Trump. The thing is, he's more respectful even than Trump, because Trump is making all these proposals completely seriously, saying he's going to use economic force to take over our country. And there's just so many issues with that. But yeah, exactly. Let's get into tariffs, because that's probably the thing that's going to most concretely affect Canadians' lives in the next few months, if they do happen. And I just want to say a quick word on tariffs in terms of sovereignty, because a lot of this is about the issue of sovereignty. And how the Americans really are not respected, particularly, you know, the American right, Trump, are not respecting Canadian sovereignty. And I think part of that is because we are so dependent on the United States for our trade. You know, our trade to GDP ratio is 67%. So 67% of our GDP is trade. And in comparison, in the U.S., that's just 25%. So trade is a much smaller percentage of their GDP. And then our percentage of our trade that's with the U.S. is around 65%. And in contrast, Canadian trade to the U.S. for the Americans is only 17%. So the overall takeaway being that Canadian trade or trade with the U.S. in Canada is extremely important to our economy. And in the U.S., it's much less important to their economy.
Right.
And also, they are much more self-sufficient, less reliant on trade than other countries, and better positioned to engage in these sorts of trade wars that Trump is proposing. So even if his trade wars are dumb and will hurt the U.S., they'll hurt other people more.
Right.
And maybe that's a sacrifice he's willing to make if he's trying to achieve certain objectives, which is why I think the idea of using economic force to annex Canada is not quite as outlandish as it seems.
Yeah, right. Because we do have to. I mean, you mentioned like his objectives. I mean, his objectives in the first Truth Social post that he made back in November were to like shut down the border, get like fentanyl off the. It was like a pretty standard Trump fare. Now that he's talking about acquiring Canada as a state, or even doing like the, I think Kevin O'Leary was talking about like having some kind of EU situation where we had the same currency, things like that.
He killed someone with his boat. He said it was his wife. It wasn't his wife. I know the person who has a cottage next to him.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know if that's allegedly. You know, that is not a legal claim.
Yeah, no,
you know,
right.
he allegedly killed someone with his boat. Just covering our bases here. But yeah, so I mean, he's not a serious person. But like, a trade war with the U.S. would be ruinous for Canada. And if Trump's end game is to like devastate the Canadian economy in order to get Canadians
in
Canada, in order to get Canadians more on board with becoming a state, I could see that becoming a reality in kind of a far off future. You know, I don't want to get into like, you know, catastrophizing here. I don't want to speculate.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me, like the only way that this could be even a remote possibility was if Trump like completely devastated the Canadian economy and then, like he said, economic force, right? Because right now Canadians just don't want to join the U.S.
No.
I mean, like there was a poll, 82% of respondents, Canadians, were opposed to the idea of becoming a U.S. state. 13% said that we support it. This also kind of it's split on party line as well. More conservatives tend to support the idea of becoming a state, but in general,
yeah.
People strongly
oppose it. And there was the other interesting demographics I saw there too. More men, like 20% of men.
That was interesting. I didn't know what to make of that.
I mean, 13% is not an insignificant number. That's kind of surprising.
That's the other thing,
right? It's scarily
high.
21% of conservatives.
It's scarily high.
Wild.
Yeah.
And I saw another statistic, which was that Canadians. It was a survey asking Canadians whether they felt like they had a deep emotional attachment to Canada. In 2015, 64% of Canadians said that they did. And now that number is just 49%. So there's been a large drop. And pride in Canada is way down for a multitude of reasons. It was in the 80s, it was 85%. And now it's just 34%. So Canadians are far less proud to be Canadian, which proud to be Canadian is definitely something you could debate. You know, some people have legitimate grievances about things that our government did, especially to Indigenous people. But I think having an emotional attachment to Canada is very important. And you know, if we're going to remain an independent country, we need to care about being Canadian. Otherwise, we will become American. We will be subsumed in this massive state that is next to us.
I do think that, I mean, I take a little bit more of an optimistic view, is that I think that a lot of Canadians, they might not be super proud, like, of their own country, or certainly of the government right now. But I do think that most, I do think that a lot of Canadians, first of all, they define themselves as, like, kind of in opposition to being American.
English Canadians in particular, right?
Right, yeah.
Francophones are totally different.
Sure. Yeah, this is very much a, you know, Ontario context. But I do think that if the U.S. continues being overly, like, aggressive and puts forward these ruinous tariffs on the economy, I do think that it's possible that Canadians will be negatively polarized against the U.S. and against the American government, because it will have, like, very real effects on people's jobs, people's, like, families, their livelihoods. And so I think that, like, I don't expect Canadians to just roll over in a situation like that, even if Trump's tariffs have, especially if Trump's tariffs have such a devastating effect on the economy.
But the problem is that that's not the messaging. The only person standing up is Doug Ford saying, we're going to do these retaliatory things. You know, Trudeau's nowhere to be seen. Smith is saying, you know, from Alberta, Premier of Alberta is saying, we're not going to stop exporting oil. Legault has said, we're not going to stop exporting electricity. It's a lame duck response right now. And so we need to get our act together.
Right, so this last little bit is going to be more of, you know, an open forum group discussion, sort of vibe check in the room. We'll see how that works. But I have a series of questions, I guess, for the group. So I guess something that really interested me was that, like, the dynamic of minority and coalition governments in the House of Commons, like, I think that's super interesting. And, like, I think one of the characteristics I saw of minority and coalition governments is, like, legislative compromise of, you know, like, needing support across different parties to pass bills, pass laws. Do you guys think, is that better for representing the interests of the people? Like, what are the dynamics at play there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the Liberals, the coalition government has made the Liberals have to kind of concede on some more, like, NDP-focused legislation. And I know, like, the dental care plan that was mainly an NDP proposal that was adopted by the Liberals.
Yeah.
So, like, things like that, you know, those would be the benefits of having, like, you know, a coalition government where you're kind of getting more parties into the legislative process, and you're making those kinds of concessions. So in this way, the Liberals can be pulled
further left. You're right.
I will say the NDP has really had trouble differentiating itself from the Liberals, and that some of the more left-wing policies that they have proposed, I could see them being proposed by the Liberals even if the NDP weren't there necessarily. I mean, I guess the NDP does sort of act in a way to draw votes away from the Liberals, which makes them shift more to the left. But I mean, let's say the NDP didn't exist, then, you know, left-wing people would only have the option to vote for the Liberals outside of Quebec. So, I don't know. I mean, minority governments are unstable. So
how established would you say the NDP is as a party? Because I know that, like, they've never had a prime minister. Am I correct?
Yeah, but they've been around for ages.
Right.
They've been the NDP since at least the 70s. And then before that, it was the CCF, mm-hmm. which formed out of Saskatchewan. And they're the ones, actually, Tommy Douglas, was the, he was like one of the sort of main leaders of the CCF in Saskatchewan, and he's the reason we have universal health care.
Well, NDP, I know NDP is in charge of British Columbia and Manitoba, if I'm not mistaken. Like, do they have a shot at, you know, putting forward a prime minister? Like, not for the next one, but, you know, could you see that happening down the line?
Well, down the line, I mean, anything could happen. But, like, for this upcoming election, absolutely not. But, yeah, I mean, like, you know, the NDP is more of a minor party. It's become kind of like a conservative or liberal game, like, in the federal parliament. But that's not to say that the NDP doesn't have, like, a strong voice. It's just that the voice kind of needs to be within, you know, coalitions. I don't expect them to have, like, I don't expect there to be, like, an NDP prime minister for the foreseeable future, at the very least.
So their role is more of, like, a voice of criticism rather than directing, like, change, would you say? Criticism of the Liberal Party?
Yeah, I mean, like, they have to work within, like, they have to work with the Liberal Party to get anything done. That's kind of the bottom line.
Right, and I think, so, like, is instant, like, this whole talk about snap elections and, you know, rotating prime ministers and all of that, and I know, Kai, you said, like, even if the Liberals do, like, pick, oh, this person is going to be our premier or leader of the Liberal Party, is, like, is instability a marker of the Canadian political system, like, with all of that going on?
Well, I don't know if we need to, like, keep breaking down the Canadian political system, because this is, like, a really widespread political system. I mean, like, we're just using the British Westminster system that the UK has, Australia, New Zealand, and, like, many other former British colonies. And, like, also most parliamentary systems, even in Europe, have, like, I mean, I feel like it's just sort of a, like, mainstay of politics in general is, like, coalitions and compromise and stuff. But, like, for the particular moment right now where we have a coalition government, or we didn't have a coalition government, actually. We just had a Liberal minority government that was being supported by the NDP, and then they withdrew their support. That creates a lot of instability, and then that's dangerous because of the threats that we're facing right now, you know?
Right. Well, I guess something that's more in the, like, in the more, not recent future, what's it called? Like, near future, sorry. Like, how does the proroguing of the House of Commons until March, like, how does that affect the daily lives of Canadians? Because that's something that, you know, that's seems a really like a question. big, like, from what I understand, it's the blocking of, like, legislative actions in the House of Commons. Like, that seems like a significant move to make for Trudeau to, like, make this decision.
It just means there's no parliament, basically. So parliament won't be in session until March 24th. I don't know if anyone else wants to jump in here, but basically there's no parliament till March 24th.
Okay.
And so that means the cabinet is still around. So Trudeau is still there and his ministers can still take action to respond to Trump's tariffs if they get put in place. But we are sort of kneecapped legislatively. We're not able to pass new bills right now, which is obviously a pretty big problem for us because we're facing threats right now with Trump coming in power. And then, like we were saying earlier, this is probably just so that Trudeau can basically find a successor. And it does sort of make one wonder why, because technically Trudeau doesn't have the power to prorogue parliament. It's the governor general.
Okay.
So he had to go and ask the governor general, sort of all the quirks of our sort of parliamentary system where the king is technically our head of state, right? Governor general's his representative. He had to ask the governor general to prorogue parliament, which is a totally selfish move, basically. And the governor general said yes. And that's also sort of, I'm not sure why, really. I don't think that was the right
especially
decision.
At, like, the worst possible moment, yeah. Like, the creating the perfect storm. Yeah.
But, you know, who knows? Maybe it's not actually the worst move, because if we did have parliament, there'd probably be a confidence motion, and then we have an election. So what do you guys think? Like, is it better to have an election or no parliament, basically?
Oh, boy. I mean, it just depends on the timing. Like, I mean, if we're coming at this from, like a foreign policy perspective, we were talking a lot about, like, U.S. relations in this episode. I mean, I don't know. I expect to have an election quite soon. It's just a matter of time, because, like, I mean, the inauguration's happening, the 20th of January.
Of Trump?
Donald Trump, his inauguration is happening on the 20th. He's going to start putting forth a lot of his economic policies pretty much right away. He has a pretty good amount of power to do what he wants in that with that respect. He also has he has the trifecta, right? So, which means, you know, he has the Republicans have the presidency, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of able to do what they want, in terms of foreign policy, and just in terms of policy in general. So that's going to start coming right away. I don't know. There's no good way to respond. I don't think that proroguing parliament necessarily puts them in a good position. I don't know if having an election at this point or in the immediate future would have been a good thing too. That also would have been pretty terrible. There's no good answer.
Yeah.
Right, and I think it's interesting that the election as well is not really. It's not the population that's doing it. It's the MPs that are voting, and this is what they're like. Canadian citizens, it sort of feels like you guys have no, your hands are tied sort of in just watching this all unfold. Do you feel like you have any power in this or any say in the proceedings of what's going to happen coming up?
Well, I mean, we elect our MPs, right?
Right.
So the MPs are technically our representatives. So everyone has an MP that is, supposedly voting in their interest, but obviously politics is, it doesn't always play out like that, right? But I think, there's a lot of unknowns, and yet there is a sort of inevitability to the whole thing, which is that eventually we are going to have an election, and then Poilievre will probably win, and then we have to see how he's going to respond to the tariffs, and we got to buckle in, basically.
Right. So I guess all that's left to say is there's a lot of uncertainty, as usual, but...
A lot more to cover in the next couple of weeks.
Stay tuned off the hour every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Stay tuned, stay up to date. Thank you for listening.
I say, not even the dog that piss against the walls of Babylon shall escape Jah wrath. Just strong. Quake, Nika, quake, I say. Quake! Blood and fire. Blood and fire. Blood and fire. But there's no water. Who you gonna run to now? Who you gonna run to now? Why? Who you gonna run to now? When I and I hold you. Fire, 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 fire.
A good example of how Lee Perry reworked given rhythms and instrumentals, overdubbing them and changing up the spot. That was Babylon's Burning, a take on Beatdown Babylon with Maxi, 90, and Scratch, a.k.a. Maxi Romeo, 90 the Observer, the producer and performer with whom Scratch had this on-and-off relationship since the late 60s, and of course our own Lee Perry. In between, another Junior Biles collaboration, Rasta No Pickpocket, and allows me to kind of highlight the importance of Rastafarianism in the music since the late 60s, but increasingly also within Perry. And it's around this period, 72, 73, that Lee Perry really adapts the Rastafarian faith to in his own way. If we had mentioned a few weeks ago that he was more in a kind of African spiritualist vibe, he had never been close to Rastafarianism, but he had not necessarily adapted the trappings, which will be more aesthetically clear in the years to come. It's around this period that Lee Perry, writing on the success, among others, of Babylon Burning, assembles in 1972 his next album release, Africa's Blood, an album he himself describes as focused on this kind of continuing orientation or consciousness. He once said, the LP is really based on being black, just a feeling, telling the people this is the blood of Africa. So once it's done, black and white have to appreciate everything in it, because I love black, I love white, I love everyone. The album was, again, mostly instrumental, various versions of songs he'd previously recorded with vocalists and reworking.
And this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million of political prisoners in the world.
My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of her say. The voice of her say. The voice of her say, coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
Thank you.